name's Field Rickards. I'm the Dean of the Graduate School of Education, and I'm really pleased that you have been able to join us for this lecture. I acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we hold this lecture, and I pay respect to the elders both past and present of the Kulin Nation, and extend that respect to other Indigenous Australians present. We have a fairly straightforward format at the conclusion of Dr. Kern's lecture. Associate Professor Lee Waters will make a small vote of thanks. And so now, and Lee Waters is in fact the director of our school leadership program, but is a strong, not only advocate, but discipline specialist in the area of positive psychology. So it gives me great pleasure indeed to welcome Dr. Margaret Kern. Now, her birth certificate says Margaret Kern, but she's known as Peggy, so from now on, it's Peggy Kern. Peggy is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania's Positive Psychology Centre. That's Marty Seligman Centre, as most of you would know. Peggy's research has a lifespan perspective and uses statistical methods and interdisciplinary collaboration to investigate individual and social factors that lead to and alter individual trajectories towards health, towards well-being, and towards resilience. More specifically, she examines how to define health and how to define psychological well-being and individual differences, and how best to measure these constructs at individual and societal levels, the relation between physical, psychological, social, and operational function at different ages across the lifespan, and the mechanisms and moderators involved in relations that we observe. Peggy completed her PhD at the University of California, Riverside in 2010, so she's a recent graduate and young postdoctoral student indeed, or fellow indeed. Physical activity, personality, social context, and health, a lifespan perspective. That was the title of her thesis. Peggy arrived in Melbourne this morning. It's not as bad as it seems. She spent the last 2 weeks in Adelaide working at the Adelaide Thinkers in Residence team. But she came to Adelaide at the request of Professor Martin Seligman. He's head of the Centre of Positive Psychology I mentioned before at the University of Pennsylvania. He was one of this year's Adelaide's Thinkers in Residence. And I extend my thanks indeed to the South Australian Department of Premier and Cabinet for allowing this lecture to take place tonight. Martin Seligman, as I said, his work as the Adelaide Thinker in Residence resulted in the idea of building South Australia as the flourishing state, a broad and ambitious goal to do this for an entire state. But Seligman and Adelaide have been addressing the question as to what can be done to increase the well-being of South Australians. How can South Australia unlock the higher skills of their citizens in order to reap the social, the economic and cultural benefits? South Australia is developing a 5-year strategy that aims to produce a population with better mental health, better productivity, more resilience, and greater capacity for the joy of life. So a key component of this strategy involves the measurement of well-being, particularly of children, and measuring it now. And Peggy's stay in Adelaide is focused on that, developing that strategy. How do we measure well-being across a state? And our own interest in exploring the role of positive psychology in education and indeed society more generally as an approach creates, I mean, we have this keen interest and how that creates positive social change. So I look forward to providing you with more information about that in the future. So enough from me. So tonight's lecture, Wellbeing, the Rutted Road to Optimal Life Outcomes. Please join me in welcoming Peggy to the lectern.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me here tonight. A pleasure to spend a day in Melbourne. It's really been just a great time spending a bit of time on the other side of the world, where I was met with winter as opposed to the depth of summer where I left. So when we look at people, it's easy to observe striking individual differences in health and well-being and really the lives that people live. This is Joe Grant. He's a pioneer aviator. He was very innovative in developing the aviation fleet. He works 6 days a week. He makes puzzle rings, and he's been in business since 1947. He spent a couple years in Saudi Arabia setting up their national piloting force, and he still flies with the sun, lives alone, and drives. Now, this is pretty interesting. The most striking thing about this is that he's 101 years old. It's pretty impressive. In contrast, Chris Farley is an American actor. He starred in various movies and whatnot. He was in Tommy Boy, American show Saturday Night Live. He starred in a lot of episodes. A very, very successful career. About 1997, he started to appear with health problems, and he ended up dying at age 33 from a drug overdose. And so he had been treated for obesity and probably had some heart problems as well. So through these two stories, we see very different pathways. One that is very flourishing throughout his very long extended life. Another one who had some success, but ended up having problems with drugs, with his health, and whatnot. And the question is, what really distinguishes these different life paths? And so a lot of my research is really looking at these big pictures of what are the trajectories that people follow across their lives, and what leads to both health and well-being outcomes along the way. Through this, I see a lot of this as a journey, and as I've entered the world of positive psychology through working at the Positive Psychology Center, working directly with Martin Seligman, it's sort of been a journey learning about well-being, and I think it represents the road that we perhaps have in front of us. So over the next about 40 minutes, I want to talk about a bit of a journey. Look at a journey of looking where we've been and from the lens of positive psychology, where we might move forward. And I see this as a bit of an adventure. So as I look at this road ahead, I think there's a lot of potential there of where it can lead us. And yet at the same time, with every adventure, there are things we don't expect. There are challenges that we must face, and I think that's where we're going to go in the future. All right, so diving into this journey. I moved to Philadelphia 2 years ago after living on the west side of the country, so it's a very different world there. I come from the desert, and then I moved to a place with trees and green and creeks and whatnot. And when I first moved to Philadelphia, things were very confusing to me. Everything looked the same when I went on roads, and it was a very different world than where I came from. Now, I'm a cyclist, and so I had to go out and try to explore this world before me. Now, when I started doing this, I wanted to stick to the straight and narrow, because what I found was I was really scared to get off that main track, because if I did, I'd get lost and I'd never make it home again. And so it would take a while for me to venture off and explore and really experience all that Pennsylvania and Philadelphia has to offer. So I started to think of this as we have a freeway that is kind of the straight and narrow way. It's what's known as the easy route. And it's not necessarily the most adventurous, but it's what we often follow because it's the easy way to go. And so I like to think of this as an analogy for well-being. When I think about well-being, there's changing views of our perspective on this. Across multiple fields, there's always been kind of this concept of well-being, defined in various different ways. In medicine, which a lot of my background is in health psychology, and so we're really looking at this idea of lack of disease and disability. So when you talk to doctors, it's very much that you're healthy until you have disease, and then we need to try to heal you so that you're well again. In psychology, our concept of well-being is really a lack of depression, a lack of anxiety, a lack of problems is really what we want to see. And a lot of our interventions and whatnot are aimed at really building this. In economics, the idea of well-being is wealth, productivity, and especially at a national level, we measure how well our country is doing based on how much income we have, things like gross national product, gross domestic product, and employment rates and things like that. And education, we often focus on academic achievement. There is a lot of, at least in the US, and I'll preface, a lot of this is based on some of my experiences in the US. There's a big focus on remediation of problems, especially as classrooms have been stressed more and more. There's a big emphasis on dealing with the problems as opposed to really doing what teachers want to do most, is inspire and really build the well-being of their students. A common thread across these is that well-being is defined as a lack of problems. And that's really the framework that we've been in for the past few decades. Now, what's this alternative journey or this alternative route? And this is where we look at the field of positive psychology. So positive psychology has really taken off as a field over the past couple decades. So from the positive psychological perspective, which is the scientific study of optimal human function, and I think the scientific is a key aspect of that, that we really want to make sure what we're doing is empirically based and there's research underlying things. We're really looking at what goes right in life, not merely what goes wrong. And so it's a shift in perspective. Some insight we have from positive psychology, which I'll return to momentarily, subjective well-being is important. We're seeing more and more evidence of this. And positive states may actually have some pretty lasting effects. Putting this into a different form, the positive side of mental health, oftentimes, traditional study of well-being is really focusing on moving from problems to no symptoms. So this middle of the road path. When we look at positive psychology, this idea of flourishing, we're really looking at moving beyond this, moving to something more, whether it's wellness or achievement or people feeling the best they possibly can. Across different fields, this is kind of the framework that we're moving towards. From depression to feeling fine is kind of the normal way of looking at things. And really, we want to look at this idea of flourishing across multiple domains. In healthcare, it's interesting talking with doctors, and they have a really hard time of thinking of, well, what's health if it's not just lack of disease? And so it's the idea of something more than that, building towards wellness. And in education has kind of been built into it for a very, very long time, this idea of excellence. And I think education, the idea has been there much longer than in some of these other fields. Now, why should we care about positive psychology, this idea of flourishing, well-being? We see across different outcomes that there are some very real outcomes there. Back in 1967, Hamburg and Adams noticed that many patients are remarkably resourceful, even in the face of catastrophic situations. Early on, there's suggestion that even when people deal with very traumatic things, people find meaning in things, and we see some positive outcomes. Several years ago, I did a meta-analysis, so we combined 150 different experimental and longitudinal studies that were looking at positive affect, life satisfaction, positive states on health outcomes. Across these different studies, we found a significant effect. So it was an R of about 0.14, which in medicine is actually a pretty large effect. I'll come back to effect size a little bit later. So this is suggesting that, and so these were experimental where they were manipulating states or longitudinally. So we were trying to get some at ways that well-being can actually improve health. There is a reciprocal relationship there. When people feel healthier, they also report feeling better. So we were getting at there is some effect going on there. Reviews, Sonia Lubomirsky in the United States has done some very good work. There's benefits in occupation, so people have report better social relationships, marriages go better, higher levels of achievement. Across different fields, we do see some benefits coming from people reporting higher well-being, building these positive states or whatever. Now, what do I mean by well-being? I'll come back to that momentarily. A lot of my work has looked at personality or individual differences. And so one positive trait that I have done a lot of work on is conscientiousness. Conscientiousness are people who are self-controlled, responsible, dependable, organized. So several years ago, I did a meta-analysis on studies that have looked at this positive personality trait and longevity, how long people live. Interestingly enough, so there were 20 different studies, and these ranged from, there was one study that followed people across their entire lives from childhood through mortality, the end of their lives. There were others that followed people, some were patient groups, about 9,000 people altogether. All studies found a significant, a protective effect of conscientiousness. Altogether, it was a correlation of 0.11. Now, when we actually worked this out, this actually translates to about a 2 to 4 year difference between people who are low in conscientiousness versus high in conscientiousness in how long they're living. Graphically, we have, mortality, how long you live along the y-axis there. And these are graphs for males and females who are high versus low in conscientiousness. Now, what we see is males are at a higher risk of mortality across their lives than female. This is something that we see across longevity studies. The lowest risk at any given age is for females who are high on conscientiousness. So they were at the lowest risk of dying at any given age. The highest risk were for your unconscientious, your impulsive, your unresponsible males. Now, a question that arises from this is why? And that's further work that we're working on. Conscientious people tend to engage in better health behaviors. They have better social relationships. So there's a series of reasons why that's actually occurring. So it's interesting that we see these real effects coming from this positive trait. Now, interestingly enough, this idea of well-being is growing in the public interest. From a public health policy perspective, our goals are to optimize life expectancy, reduce physical, psychological, and social morbidity, and maintain high quality of life. These ideas have been there for a very long time, and countries have focused a lot on optimizing life expectancy. There's growing interest in maintaining this high quality of life, this psychological side of things that maybe we should pay attention to. There is a growing international interest in incorporating well-being into public policy. So there's a lot of high-level discussions that are going on right now that governments are starting to say, we need to actually look at how people are subjectively doing in their lives. A lot of this work is being led by the United Kingdom. The Cameron administration, they've actually decided to add some well-being measures to the national surveys that they do. The country of Bhutan has decided that they want to be a flourishing country. They have a national measure of gross national happiness, and basically they're structuring it into everything that they do as a country. During my discussions this past week in Adelaide, there was a lot of discussion going on there about how to make South Australia a flourishing state. And so it's interesting that there's a lot of conversations that are going on. Back in April, there was a meeting by the UN talking specifically about well-being. So there's an international discussion that's going on. And so there's interest in this, and the question is, where do we go from here? So the question that comes from this is, we've been talking about we want people to do well. That's what, when we measure how well a country is doing, that's really the idea that we want to get at. Now, traditionally, there's been a big focus on how our country is doing is based on how much wealth we have, or some of these other objective measures. And there's growing consensus that if we want to look at the well-being of people, we need to measure it directly and ask people how they're actually doing. And so that's where discussions are going to. But as I look at this, I see this as an adventure in a lot of ways. There's talk of we need to measure well-being, we need to actually look at this, and yet in a lot of ways it's unknown territory. And whenever we enter unknown territory, there are a lot of things that we might not know is ahead of us. Look, what are some of these unexpected things or challenges that we're going to face ahead? And I think this is where research is going to be very, very valuable, is that there's a lot of potential there as we move forward. One question is, what is well-being? And this is actually, as I went to and started working at the Positive Psychology Center, we have several projects that are working on measuring well-being. And as I entered this work, I quickly discovered this is actually much more challenging than I first thought, because in part, we can't even agree on what well-being is. There's a lot of discussion of, well, how do we even define this? Early on, I think there was a big emphasis on happiness. And I think a lot of times, myself included, when I think of well-being, I think of, well, how happy are you? And we have to make everyone happy, and that doesn't always sit well. We talk about it more as something that's much more than happiness. One definition, so Diener defines subjective well-being as subjective perspectives on how life is going. So it's really getting at people reflecting on how their life is. Back in 1948, the World Health Organization defined health, or well-being essentially, as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, not merely the absence of disease and infirmity. Now, it's interesting, they said this back in 1948, and yet throughout the past 50 years, essentially, there's been a main focus on physical health and lack of disease and disability. And so how can we actually incorporate the psychological, the social side of things into our understanding of what well-being is? One model of this, there's a lot of different models here. So working at the Positive Psychology Center, I'm working with Martin Seligman, he has a model of flourishing. And we've been doing a lot of work with this model. According to this model, there are five different aspects of well-being, or five pillars, under the acronym of PERMA. Positive emotion, engagement, relationship, meaning, and accomplishment. He suggests that people pursue these in and of themselves, and we can actually measure these and look at these. And so this is a model that we're working with a lot. One thing I like about this is that it's looking at multiple aspects of well-being. Now, this is something to work with, it's something to build upon, and yet we still need to do a lot of work on really supporting the model, really seeing how we infuse this into the work that we actually do. And so one challenge that we have as we move forward is really understanding how we really should be defining well-being and how that in turn is going to inform what we do. Now, once we define things, then as we go along our journey, a big question becomes, how do we measure it? And what are some of the issues that are going to be involved in this? And I think this is kind of on our journey. There are a lot of twisted routes that we can pick. And so this is going to be part of the journey that we follow and the adventure that unfolds before us. Now, what are some of these issues, some of these challenges that we need to consider as we look at measuring well-being and moving forward with it? There's a lot of talk of measuring population well-being. And yet, then there's also individual measures. So there's a lot of measures out there, and we're looking at different levels. In some sense, we want to look at how a population is doing, and yet, how does that actually apply to the individual? I think with a government, they want to be able to look at, okay, give me a number that says how my country is doing. That gives us a talking point to work with. And yet, if we really want to intervene and work with a student who we want to improve their well-being, or a coworker where we want to improve our relationships with, then some of those individual level measures are going to be important. So how that unfolds is still going to be a question before us. Another thing to consider is, as we talk about well-being, we don't want to exclude the negative. And so in some of the discussions I've had back with people in the States, there's a lot of excitement about, well, let's help people flourish, and we don't really need to consider problems or depression or anxiety. Really, we need to look at the full broad spectrum of things. And so when we add well-being measures, they're really to supplement the other measures that we have that are out there so that we really get a full picture of where people are in their lives and how to help them thrive in the best way possible across the broad range of things. Now, another question is how we really present things. And I think this is going to be a really key discussion that needs to move forward, that we, those of us working on some of this well-being measurement stuff, I don't think have paid attention to enough, but we'll need to in the future. How much do we aggregate things together versus present things across a dashboard? And I think a key aspect of the well-being stuff is the story that we tell. How do we present the information to people, whether it's policymakers who want a quick answer to things or to someone who wants to know, well, how does this influence my life? Some work that I've been working with Matthew White and Lee Waters, measuring boys' well-being at St. Peter's College in Adelaide. So in November, we did a baseline survey of how the boys were doing across a series of measures. And this is kind of a dashboard of indicators that we put together across the scales that we measured. So in this case, we looked at a series of measures, and the blue is the St. Peter's College boys. The reds are standardized norms, and so it gives a bit of comparison of how the boys are doing across the whole broad range. What we find is actually the boys are actually doing pretty well compared to some of the published norms. So this is one way that we could think about, well, let's look at information that we have. The OECD is an international group that's looking at the well-being of nations around the world, And they've really taken on this idea of this dashboard. They have a series of 10 different indicators of well-being. Now, some of these are much more social indicators, and they're drawing on existing data sources in order to get a picture of how countries are doing. So this includes things like housing, jobs and earnings, social connections, health status, subjective well-being. And they've classified nations. And so, for example, this is Australia and how they're doing across the different indicators. Comparison, we have the United States. And so you kind of get a flower of how they're doing across the different indicators. And it's pretty interesting. If you go on the website, you can actually look at, OK, well, then what does this information mean? And where is this information drawn from? So it's an interesting way to visually look at how different people are doing, or how countries are doing in this case, in order to give us a way to walk forward. All of this is just bringing something more to the table in order to consider, in order to get the discussion going. There still needs to be more discussion and more work done on what do we do with this and how does it actually inform policy. Now, a big discussion that has gone on at the international level with measuring this idea of population well-being is the idea of objective versus subjective measures. At the policy level, there's a real emphasis on we need to use objective indicators that people actually can't tell us how they're doing. They're biased in some way. Though when we think about subjective well-being, people are probably the best ones to actually tell us how they're doing. But it's interesting when you get at that level that most of those indicators that OECD uses are things that you can observe objectively. Some work that we have going on at Penn is a very interesting project where we're looking at social media to see if we can use social media, so things like Facebook, Twitter, these social networks, in order to unobtrusively look at how people are doing. It's been a very interesting project of developing massive data sets and learning how to work with this. So we've started with a project. We have a data set with about 4 million Facebook users with about 20 million status updates. And they all have completed a personality test, which indicate or just kind of individual differences on the big five measures. And we looked at personality traits and the words that people use the most. So for example, this is high extroversion. So people who are highly extroverted tend to be active, social, your people who like to go to the party, dance, and things like this. On Facebook, the words that they happen to be using most are things like party, weekend, chillin', excitin', girls. I was actually amazed when all of this came together and these are the words that we saw. This is high neuroticism, so proneness towards anxiety, depression. The words they're using most are things like depressed, lonely, scared, anxious, sick of, screaming. You start to get a sense of if this is what they're posting on Facebook all the time, no wonder they're kind of feeling down and whatnot. Now, I'll note this is actually the PG-rated version. They actually used swear words the most, so it was very much very abrasive language, and so forth. I decided to not put that in there, and it's kind of instructive to see what else is there. So this is, we're starting to work with all of this. The idea is ultimately, could we actually get a measure of PERMA using the words that people use? So we've started with Facebook. We have a whole set of Twitter data right now that we just got the computing power essentially to look at that. The data is there. There's questions of privacy and whatnot, the data is there. How can we draw on it, especially the younger generation where they're on social media all the time? So interesting work on kind of how can we address this concern of subjective reports with information that people are putting out there anyways. Okay, so these are some of the things that we can consider, some of the issues that we're going to have to face along the way. Now, as we go on a journey, it's important to take a look at a map. And as I've explored Philadelphia, this is actually a map of the Philadelphia area. As I've placed things on the map, it's helped me get a look at a bigger, it's given me a picture of, okay, how do things connect? How can I actually get around so that if I end up here, I actually will make it back to my house sometime in the next week? And so it's very helpful to have this big picture perspective. And so a lot of my interest as I move forward in my research is really to connect these big ideas together. So what are some of these big picture things that we need to keep in mind as part of our journey? One of them is the need to look at things over time. And so a lot of my interest is in what are the pathways that people follow. And to do this, we really need to look at, okay, not just one snapshot on time, but what's the pathway that people follow. For my dissertation, I looked at physical activity across the lifespan. So I used a data set of people that were followed from, it was starting in 1922, and it followed people all the way through their lives until death. And there were data collections every 5 to 10 years. So it was an archival data set that I was using. And I looked at how active they were across from about age 25 to 65. This is a graph of those physical activity trajectories that they followed. This dark line is the average trajectory over time. And when we look at these broad samples, that's really the big picture that we get. We see a general decline in activity as people get older, as we generally expect. But what I found interesting was all of these different pathways. You had some people who declined, some people who actually got more active over time, and others who bounced around. Interestingly enough, things like your personality, your relationships, your health, these actually predicted some of these different trajectories. And so as we look at, okay, who does better in life versus who does not, it's going to be important to look at people over time. How do their lives unfold within the context that they have? How does their personality influence things? Connected to this is the fact that multiple things influence people's well-being. And so things like your health influences how people report how they're doing. The environment that people are in. I've had some discussions this past week where people are asking, well, okay, this well-being stuff is very interesting. We're interested in looking at this, but how does it work in disadvantaged communities? How does it work with Aboriginal people? How does these social contexts really affect things? And these are areas where a lot more attention needs to be paid to really look at people in their context. Individual elements, things like your personality. These all together are going to influence how people report how they're doing and the associated outcomes. A group in Canada who is looking at the well-being of the Canadian citizens is using a nice socio-ecological model. So in their model, you have well-being in the middle, but then that's influenced by people's education, their time use, how healthy is the environment, looking at the community. So people within their community, and then at the broader level, things that government can really structure and define. So things like your living standard, and what's the environment like. And so really looking at this big picture idea of people in their context, and there are different ways that we can intervene at different levels. Now, on any journey, there's unknown territory. There are things where we have hints in the research, but there's a lot of work we have left to do, a lot of exploration on our journey ahead. Can we increase well-being? There are interventions out there to increase well-being. How much do they last over time? How do they affect different people? And so there's a lot of questions on that as we move forward. It's going to be a very much a realm of active research where I think there's a lot of opportunities as we move forward. Will change translate into desirable outcomes? And I think one question as kind of this big picture perspective to keep in mind is it's easy to get this idea of, well, we want more well-being. Well, what does that actually look like? What does that actually mean? Is that completely desirable? Is there such a thing as too much well-being, too much focus on some of these different elements of well-being? It's still uncharted waters that we need to follow in the future. When we consider about actually trying to change behavior, I think thinking of well-being as a health behavior in some ways can actually be an interesting model. As a kind of a side example, I think smoking is a prime example of a nationwide change. So in the US, smoking was a huge problem. Pretty much smoking was everywhere. And there was a really big push starting in about the 80s to start decrease how much people smoke. At this point, I think less than 25% of our population smokes, and so there's been massive decreases over time. Now, what worked? In some cases, it was individual level things, where people had a patch or they went to different treatments and whatnot. Some things were social and peer group influences, where social groups said, hey, you need to stop smoking and really build this in. There were changing role models, so changing what's on TV and whatnot. Cultural institution norms that used to be in the US, you'd sit around in classrooms and smoke, and now smoking is banned in most places. And then also federal and societal limitations, so there's extremely high taxes on smoking now, and so a lot of that has changed. Now, each of this has worked some of the time for some people. Now, how does this apply to well-being? If we want to increase people's well-being, then it's not a one-size-fits-all type thing. Part of it is going to be maybe at the government level, structuring environments to support people's well-being. In other aspects, it's really working with communities and seeing what the people want to do in order to build and inspire their own perspective on things. Last week, I was at Mount Barker High School in Adelaide, and so we're going to measure the well-being of the students there. And so we were doing a focus group with the students, and we asked them, you know, are the students going to go for this? Are they going to get into the survey and actually complete it, or are they just going to blow it off? And they had a really interesting response. They said, well, I think they could get this, but it has to come from us. It has to have students that are actually saying, this is something, this is going to inspire some change in our school, and this is worth doing. And they had that perspective that it needed to be driven from them. And in a lot of ways, if we're going to build well-being, then a lot of it needs to happen at the community level and really seeing how communities want to be involved in order to see what change is possible. Some further explorations. There's a growing number of studies on youth, especially adolescents. A lot of these are in small specific populations. How this applies kind of broadly to our youth is still an area where we need a lot of work done. We need guidelines to monitor outcomes. What does it really look like? Again, questions that have been asked about building well-being and whatnot, the same things can be asked about how does all of this apply to youth at different levels. Again, we need increased collaborations at all levels, and the need for really measuring things. And so coming back to measuring things and then figuring out what we do with those measures. How do we report it? How do we work with that? That's going to be areas that we need to develop in the future. Youth have an important perspective, going back to people in their context and really talking to the youth themselves, just like we need to talk to people and see how they're doing. And I think with youth especially, we want to consider social media. So going back to that, they're on social media a lot. How can we tap into that in order to understand and perhaps build well-being? As we go on this journey, this big picture idea, interdisciplinary collaborations are going to be key. So multiple perspectives across different fields are really going to be important. Drawing on medicine, drawing on economics, drawing on education, really working together to really build well-being across a lot of different domains. Across these different domains, we've followed this freeway of focusing on fixing problems, what's gone wrong. And I think there's a lot of potential moving towards this idea of flourishing, this idea of positive psychology, or just well-being in general. It's an adventure. There's a lot of uncharted territory. There's been some very good research that's been done, but really how it all applies, how it all comes together, there's a lot of areas open where we need a lot of work to go. And so we should proceed, but cautiously, and keep in mind those big issues of following people over time, looking at people in their context, understanding things from people's perspectives. Putting this together, we need collaborative, interdisciplinary, process-oriented research to successfully navigate the bumps, detours, and curves on the journey ahead of us. So it's an adventure as we explore this road of understanding, building well-being in people in our communities. I leave with a final quote. Henry David Thoreau said, "To enhance the quality of the day, that is the highest of the arts." So thank you.
Thanking you, Peggy, on behalf of the audience for an engaging and thought-provoking presentation. I really enjoyed the metaphor of the freeway versus the rutted road, and I think that was a really nice way to set up the presentation. It's highly relevant for people who are researching in the field. I think we still have these big questions about what is well-being, how do we measure it, and therefore how do we cultivate it. And some researchers will need to take the freeway path and look at what are the common elements across the human condition that lead to well-being. And some researchers will take the rutted road and look at all the way, the little deviant pathways that people take and the setbacks that people have and the different contexts. So that's a useful metaphor for researchers in the group. But I think it's also a really useful metaphor for all of us just as individuals. And I'm sure I'm not alone in saying that there have been stages in my life where my well-being is cruising along the freeway, and then all of a sudden I'm along the rutted path in a place I wasn't expecting to take. And you know, how do we make meaning of those curves in the road? And how do we make meaning of the challenges and climbing up the hills that we weren't expecting? And how do we grow through life's adversities so that they don't, so that detour doesn't take us away from well-being, but that we ultimately come back onto the freeway with a better vehicle? So I think it was a really lovely metaphor. It's also a useful metaphor for people who are researching in the field because, as you say, it is an unknown journey at the moment. Traditional measures of well-being have been more economic, and we're now starting to see that actually subjective well-being is very legitimate, and it's a very useful pathway for understanding well-being. And it is an unknown territory, but it's really exciting, and it means that we can incorporate the science. Your social media research is a really great example of bringing in science to an unknown journey and really making meaning of it for people who use that media. I'm going to be much more careful about the words I use on Facebook from now on. I never swear on Facebook, so I should. I think I'm up in the top.
I'm very careful now about what I post.
Yeah, absolutely.
On my account.
So this notion of subjective reports, which you've called for, is really important, but I think ultimately the way you wrapped it up and talked about the fact that research into individual subjective well-being needs to be built into public policy, and we need to understand the context, and make this a community initiative is also equally important. So I want to thank you so much for a thought-provoking and engaging presentation. We have a gift to extend our gratitude. Thank you so much for coming to Melbourne for the day.
Thank you.
It's a short visit, but hopefully it's been a visit that you will remember. And thank you so much also for giving up your time to come and talk to people tonight. Jet lag is a bit of an issue, I know. And also Peggy has been unwell over the weekend. She's caught the Australian flu. So thank you so much for rallying yourself off the rutted path to come back to the freeway to talk to us tonight. We have our gift of treasure.